The Democratic National Convention came to a close last night with Hillary Clinton officially accepting her party's nomination for president.
Tonight, we've reached a milestone in our nation's march toward a more perfect union. The first time that a major party has nominated a woman for president.
We'll have an Illinois delegation reaction from Clinton's speech.
No, I have to do this my way. You tell me what you know, and I'll confirm. I'll keep you in the right direction if I can, but that's all. Just follow the money.
Recognize that clip from the 1976 movie All the President's Men, based on the book with the same name? We continue our summer reading series with books on politics and political biographies. And Chicago-based musician Evan Weiss from the band Intuit Over It joins us. That's all coming up on today's edition of The 21st. Stay tuned. Hi, I'm Nyla Boodoo. Welcome to the 21st. Last night, Park Ridge, Illinois-born Hillary Clinton officially accepted the Democratic nomination for president. The Illinois delegation had special front stage seating for the historic night. Democratic presidential nominee Hillary Clinton's closing speech was met with a downpour of balloons and cheers from the crowd, who spent much of the speech chanting her name. Here's former Illinois State Representative Naomi Jacobson, who said Clinton's speech was the best she's ever heard her give. As balloons popped around her, Representative Jacobson also said it was exciting to see a woman as the party's presidential nominee.
I really think that, as we heard so many times tonight, stronger together. And that's where we have to be, not separated, not trying to do things by ourselves. But as Hillary wrote that book a long time ago, it takes a village.
Many in the Democratic National Convention crowd, like Illinois State Representative Ann Williams of Chicago, said they were happy with the message that Hillary Clinton's speech set for the coming months of the election.
I'm really excited about tonight. I think she was right on message. She delivered what she needed to deliver tonight to bring the country together and to, get us all excited about the future and excited about winning a big victory in November.
Not everyone share that excitement. Some Bernie Sanders supporters are still upset over the Democratic nomination, tried chanting at numerous points during Clinton's speech. Bernie Sanders delegate Allison Squires had black makeup drawn on her mouth to symbolize that they had been sewn shut by the DNC.
Maybe I'll just protest and not vote for president. I'm not sure.
Thanks again to Illinois Public Radio's Amanda Vinicky for those clips. We're going to continue to check in with her throughout the presidential race into November. Today, we're continuing our summer book series. We're going to be talking about politics and political books. And one of the folks I asked to come on to help compile a reading list for us is Carol Felsenthal. She joins us from Chicago. She's a magazine writer. She's a blogger for Chicago Magazine, Politico, and The Hill. Carol, welcome back to the 21st. Thanks for being with us.
Sure. Thanks for having me.
Before we get to political books, Carol, I have to ask about your observations about yesterday evening, this week, the past 2 weeks of conventions that we've been going through.
Well, I'm waiting to see if Hillary gets a bounce, because Donald Trump did. And if you look at the polls now, he's leading. And I think that's going to be pretty fascinating to see what happens there. I thought Hillary's speech, which I watched from the newsroom studio of WGN on Michigan Avenue, with lots of people walking by the window, including at least a few wearing the T-shirt Hillary for prison, taking up on that theme in the Republican convention.
Wait, just to be clear, Carol, you said Hillary for prison.
Yes, that's
okay.
A T-shirt that's popular out there, and it speaks to the message that Trump is pushing, that Hillary deserves to be locked up, not running for the White House. So I thought Hillary's speech was workmanlike. I didn't think it was inspirational. But then I thought Bill Clinton's speech was kind of ridiculous. So I didn't. I'm apart from the conventional.
So then I have to ask, what did you think of President Obama's speech two nights ago?
President Obama's speech. Hillary Clinton does not know how. I know this has been ridiculed as a sexist comment, but it's hard to listen to her. Barack Obama makes music. On the other hand, if you deconstruct his speech, which I did, you'll find that it was more about him than it was about her, which doesn't mean that he didn't give. He desperately, whatever the two of them think of each other, really, he desperately needs her to win, because otherwise his legacy will be put on hold and may never be revivable. So I believe that President Obama will campaign his heart out for her, and I also believe Michelle Obama, who I think gave the speech of the convention, will do the same.
Carol, I wonder how you thought Illinois and Illinois politicians featured this week in the DNC. Of course, Illinois being played such a prominent role on the national political scene with President Obama over the past 8 years. The Illinois delegation getting sort of front and center seating just stage left yesterday evening. But I'm thinking about the week. I'm thinking about us, national media, seeing Cook County President Tony Preckwinkle sitting next to Bill Clinton, Rahm Emanuel throwing a party yesterday evening. He finally showed up at the DNC yesterday. Wonder what your thoughts are on Chicago and Illinois politicians and how the role that they played on the national political scene this week.
Well, definitely Tony Preckwinkle was a winner because of that at his elbow scene in with President Clinton. On the other hand, Tony Preckwinkle had asked for a speaking spot and hadn't been given one, so that was kind of a consolation prize. Rahm, as Chris Elizza of the Washington Post, in picking his winners or losers, put Rahm in the loser category. He was such a loser this week. I mean, it was... I cover him very closely, but I have to say I almost felt sorry for him. That video that played that showed him being a craven, calculating.
Right, because it was that one line, the Guggenheim video that introduced Barack Obama, where he says, you got to pull the bill.
Right, but it makes him look like he couldn't care less about the welfare of people who struggle without health insurance. It was really an indictment. Also, we were watching on several screens last night during the Hillary Clinton speech, and I think, well, I'm not going to say which one, but it was one of the broadcast networks which, when the words out of Hillary's mouth were about children and violence and gunfire, the camera focused on Rahm Emanuel. I couldn't believe it. I felt like that was really another... knife in his heart.
Well, for better or for worse, I mean, I think that's a national perception of Chicago, isn't it, Carol? That if we're talking about children and gun violence, right?
No, totally. But you know, the question is it might have been a coincidence. I don't know.
Oh, you mean blaming Mayor Emanuel?
Well, putting him in the picture, yeah. And then, like political conventions, first of all, I think they are a very outmoded form of communication today. But it's all about politicians scrambling to get a place in the next election. So in the Illinois delegation, one of the major themes is who's going to take on Rauner and run for president. And of course, Dick Durbin was the center of that speculation, and also the mayoral race in 2019. So I found that really fascinating.
Carol, you said something to me yesterday earlier this week when I asked you to join us for this segment as we were talking about political books. You said actually that this election cycle, truth is a little stranger than fiction.
Well, it's true, and it's something that I probably say too often, and my husband has heard it 130 times, that one of the reasons why I love covering politics is that you cannot make up the ins and outs of political lives. And just looking at the Bill Clinton speech of the other night, the Clinton marriage, if I wanted to write a novel and I wanted to make them major characters in the novel, any serious editor would say, you can't do that. Nobody's going to believe that. But it happens in politics every day. I mean, just look at the Trump and the what he's saying about the encouraging the Russians to release Hillary's emails. And then now there's another news story that the DCCC is saying that it was hacked. And, you know, by whom, who knows, but presumably the point of that is to get information on Democratic donors. It's just, it's a drama every 30 minutes. And I think it is absolutely, which is why I read a lot of fiction, but my fiction reading tends not to be about politics, and I read many, many books on politics and learn something from most of them.
All right, so let's segue to our summer book series. This edition today, we're talking about politics and political books. Those of you listening, if you have a favorite book about politics that you want to recommend, fiction or not, give us a call. Our phone number is 1-800-222-9455. That's 1-800-222-9455. You can tweet to 21st Show, 21ST Show. We're talking about them with Carol, and I want to bring another person into this conversation, a librarian from Champaign Public Library who's in studio with me, Nanette Donahue. In addition to working as an assistant manager of adult services at the library, she's also on the executive board of the Illinois Library Association, and she's also a published author herself. Nanette, welcome. Thank you for being here with me.
Hi, thank you for having me.
So Nanette and Carol are here with their book recommendations, and maybe we should start with fiction, Carol, to lighten the mood a little. And Nanette, you have a couple fiction books that you came up with that you compiled for us. Let's start with The Hopefuls. What's that about?
That's a fairly recent book, just came out earlier this summer, and it follows a young couple who are living in New York City, and they get swept up in the excitement around the 2008 election. They get involved in Obama's campaign, and they're just swept up in it. And they choose to move to D.C. after he's elected. The husband, his name is Matt, he gets a job with the administration because of his work on the campaign. And Beth finds a job with a D.C.-based kind of lifestyle website. And as they become more and more enmeshed in this political world of these young up-and-comers, their relationship and their friendships really begin to suffer. It's a book that I generally would categorize in the women's fiction or domestic fiction. It's pretty literary. It's very nicely written, features engaging characters, telling a very interesting story about a specific time that's recognizable as part of modern history.
Thanks for that. Are people coming into the library this time of year, Nanette? Are they probably not asking for political books, are they?
I think people are pretty burned out on politics because it's kind of overload. Most of the political book requests we're going to get this time of year are going to be in the nonfiction category. People who want to learn more about the candidates, or people who are looking for books by pundits who are on their particular political side.
Okay, well, we have some of those too. Should we talk about some of those? Because you have on your list different biographies of both Hillary Clinton and, I guess, for Donald Trump, we just have a couple, right?
Yeah. Clinton wrote two volumes of her own autobiography, Living History, which was released back in 2003, that covers her childhood through the end of the years in the Bill Clinton White House. And it's a fascinating account, but obviously because she wrote it, it has a certain angle to it. In 2013, I believe, she released Hard Choices, which covers the Secretary of State years, her years in the Senate for New York. Both are very well written, very fascinating. But if you're looking for something that's more of an outside view, Carl Bernstein's biography, A Woman in Charge, is a good choice. You know, he's a venerable journalist. You know, he's going to come at his subject with a journalistic viewpoint. Very interesting to read and not quite so close to what was going on. As far as Trump is concerned, he's pretty new to the political scene, and most of the books that are out there about him are about his career in business. He wrote a couple of books, The Art of the Deal, Think Like a Champion, that really sort of push forward his very bombastic, very up-in-your-face personality. We haven't seen a definitive Donald Trump biography yet. I think that's going to change. I think regardless of the outcome of this election, probably within the next year or two, we will see more of a definitive Trump biography. Most of what you're going to see as far as Trump bios are those very quickie, questionable celebrity-style bios that come up when somebody gets suddenly famous. In terms of punditry, there's plenty on either side. Same thing with parody. There's parodies of Trump. There's parodies of Clinton. If you're looking for a laugh, if you're looking for support for your own personal viewpoint, chances are it's out there.
And you read Living History.
I did.
What did you think of it?
I thought it was really fascinating. It was long. I remember it took a very long time for me to read it, but it was fascinating. And it really gave that inside account of what life was like for her, both growing up, her school years, her education in law school, her relationship with her husband. I did think it was fascinating. It gave me some interesting perspective.
And Carol, we have to have you weigh in here because, of course, you're the author of Clinton in Exile. And so maybe we can talk a little bit about the Clintons and books about the Clintons for a second.
I was thinking about Bill Clinton's memoir, My Life, which I literally I used as a doorstop because my I live the way that our house is arranged yeah, and my office is situated at the top of our house.
That's not a really ringing endorsement there, Carol.
Well, no, because it was typical Bill Clinton. There were pages that were really interesting, and then he would repeat himself, and he was late with it, so it wasn't edited. The Hillary Clinton books are better. They're neater. They're more articulate, and they're less self-serving and sloppy. So I would agree with that. I thought that her memoir of her years as Secretary of State was way too much just a dump of her diaries, and I found it, you know, a really good way to get myself to sleep at night because it was, I thought it could be quite dull. And there's, I hope when she campaigns that she doesn't use that line about traveling a million miles as Secretary of State, because she did travel a lot. The question is, what did she do when she got there? And there was that devastating line by the only other woman in this whole 2016 scene, and that was Carly Fiorina, who said travel is a activity, not an accomplishment. And I kind of thought that spoke to the Hillary book. But
we're going to have to take a break. So can I put that comment on pause for a second, and we'll pick up this conversation in just a minute. We're speaking with Carol Felsenthal and Nanette Donahue about political books. I see some tweets. We're going to get to your suggestions in just a minute. Keep the tweets coming. You can call us also at 1-800-222-9455, and we'll pick up this conversation in just a few minutes.
The 21st is made possible by the library at the University of Illinois at Urbana-Champaign, fostering knowledge in its disciplines by recruiting and retaining library faculty, researchers, and thought leaders with deep subject matter knowledge and expert librarianship. The University Library at Illinois.
Welcome back to this Friday edition of the 21st. I'm Nyla Boodoo. As the DNC wraps up, we have both conventions over. We're talking political books, biographies if you want to learn more about the candidates, nonfiction if you're tired of it and want to escape from the reality that is this current political season. My guests are Carol Felsenthal. She's an author in her own right, author of Clinton in Exile, Princess Alice, The Life and Times of Alice Roosevelt Longworth. And she's also, of course, a journalist, magazine writer, blogger for Chicago Magazine, Politico, and The Hill. She's joining us from Chicago. In studio with me from Champaign and the Champaign Public Library is Nanette Donahue. She's a librarian. We're taking your suggestions, 1-800-222-9455. That's 1-800-222-9455. You can tweet to 21st Show. R.C. McBride, listening, I know, on WGLT, says, think this year is crazy? How about Hunter S. Thompson's Fear and Loathing on the Campaign Trail 72, a classic? Nanette, have you had folks recommend that to you as well?
I have. When I found out that I was going to be on the show, I put it out there to some of my Reader's Advisor friends, and that was something that one of my friends in Texas brought up as a great suggestion for people who are interested in more of a historical view, of course, with the irreverent style of Hunter S. Thompson.
Right. Carol, let's talk about some of the books on your list, because you have a classic that we talked about. We actually introduced right at the top of the show, which is All the President's Men. Why did you pick? Do you sort of feel like this is kind of the classic if you're going to pick politics in a book that maybe people who aren't interested in politics would read? Would you pick All the President's Men?
And it's fascinating because the characters in it were at the top of political life, mostly were Richard Nixon and Katherine Graham. And the movie is great, the book is better, it's been reissued, and it's kind of fascinating to me that that Carol Bernstein then shows up again as the author of a book on Hillary Clinton. And Bob Woodward is so much in the public sphere. If you watch any of the Sunday morning shows, he's frequently on the panel, and yet his books are not readable. He has in these political nonfiction books, it's very important to be able to get the interviews. And Bob Woodward is such an establishment figure, which in itself is interesting because back when they wrote All the President's Men.
Right, they were taking down the establishment.
They were taking down the establishment. They were considered to be outsiders, although they worked for the Washington Post. But they were considered to be these outsiders who were going to get to the truth. So it's all kind of the way things come around is very fascinating. So that book is a page turner, and it's a great mystery. And of course, now we know some of the answers, but it does not diminish the book at all. We know who Deep Throat was, for example, but the book still holds up very well. I read it a couple of years ago, reread it a couple of years ago.
It really is a classic, and I think all of us who are journalists, we either have read the book and watched the movie, and it's something that you have in journalism school to read, but it's always a really good one. Now, speaking of Washington Post, you also have Collision 2012 on your list, Carol. What's that about?
Well, I am a big admirer of the journalist Dan Balz, who was editor of the Daily Illini, and who now works for the Washington Post. And I like this book because it is full of insight and the kind of information that you're not going to find if you're a political junkie like I am and you read umpteen newspapers every day and every, you know, website, Politico, and the rest of them that come up with breaking news. He puts it into perspective. So I thought his book about the 2012 election especially was very good, very temperate. He's not a showy journalist. He's got that kind of Midwestern seriousness, and he's not a journalist who's looking for scandal or who's looking for the ugly underside of things. I read his columns in the Washington Post regularly, and this was just an excellent look at that election. And you know, the political books in a way are disposable because who's going to go back now and read a book about the 2012 election? Well, people like me who write books or who do research do that all the time. But there's another classic that I put on my list that's more than 1,000 pages long. It's even longer than Bill Clinton's memoir, and that's a book called What It Takes by the late, he died a couple of years ago at age 62, Richard Ben Kramer. And the book is fascinating, even though...
And this is about the 1988 presidential race,
that's
Carol?
That's right, because it took him 4 years. It took him 4 years.
It took him 4 years to write these 1,000 pages.
We happen to share the same New York literary agent, so I would hear about the trials and tribulations of writing this book. It took him so long to write that in 1988, okay, well, it's now 1992, but the writing is so smart, and it's so he's one of these people who has an enormous amount of information about stuff, and he manages to weave it into the story with all these interesting characters, including Joe Biden, who gave a very good speech this week at the Democratic convention as well. But in 1988, he had to drop out of the race over plagiarism charges, and so the material is fascinating, and it is a book.
Right,
that
it's
is
everybody
well
forgets
worth
that one. Right, we're speaking with Carol Felsenthal and Nanette Donahue about politics, political books, fiction, and nonfiction. If you have a suggestion for us, you can tweet us at 21st Show. You can call us at 1-800-222-9455. Another nonfiction book you have that I think is actually came out a couple years ago, Nanette, but I think is a really good read at any time, is A Signal in Noise by Nate Silver. Can you tell us about that?
Yeah, I put this on the list because honestly, I can't open any of my social media during election year without seeing something that someone has shared that was written by Nate Silver. And he first came into the public view during the 2012 presidential election, where he made all of these predictions about who would win the election, and they were remarkably accurate. You know, accurate to a level that people hadn't seen. And what he explains in his book is how the predictive science behind his predictions works and how human bias in interpreting that information makes all the difference. And it's really important because how good is all the big data that we're able to collect in our electronic world if we misinterpret what we get?
In which he's doing. He has a whole team at 538, which everyone, if you are a fan of 538 or if you know Nate Silver, of course, lots of people follow him on Twitter, other social media. This is kind of his definitive work.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. There's another book that you had on here also, speaking of science, The Political Mind. What's that about, Nanette?
That is a book that was written by, it's not on my list.
George Lakoff?
Yeah, George Lakoff. He is a cognitive scientist. And his viewpoint is very progressive. So if you're on the other side of things, the progressive bent may irritate you a little bit. But the science is good. And basically what he does is looks at politics through the lens of cognitive science. We've come really far in the last 10 or so years in understanding how especially the unconscious mind works. And so he takes that information and he applies it to how we view politics.
Great. 1-800-222-9455 is our number if you have suggestions for us. I'm speaking with Nanette Donahue as well as Carol Felsenthal about politics and political books. Let's go to Richard in Springfield. Hey, Richard. Welcome to the 21st. Hi. What's your suggestion?
POTUS Speaks by Waldman.
And what's it about?
It was about Clinton and how he was in love with the idea of being a president, but didn't know what he was getting into when he got there. It was Waldman was one of his original speechwriters, I believe.
Carol, can you weigh in on that? Thanks, Richard. Carol, you're familiar with that one?
I can't because I don't know that book. But
okay.
There is a whole genre of books written by speechwriters, and one of the more interesting ones, I'm not going to be able to come up with his name now, was written by George W. Bush's speechwriter. It was a devastating indictment of George W. Bush. It was considered to be a terrible betrayal. But speechwriters sometimes do come out of those jobs, and they are angry.
just want a book deal, right?
They've seen things, you know, they've seen things from the inside. So, you know, I have one of the books that I have on my list, which I found absolutely fascinating, was Robert Gates's book. He had two cabinet positions, and one in a Republican, one in a Democratic administration. He was head
Secretary
of
Secretary of Defense. He was Secretary of Defense, right?
He was Secretary of Defense, and then he was head of the CIA, and then he came out with both guns blazing at the Obama administration. Especially, you know, he portrayed President Obama as a lightweight, inexperienced, unknowledgeable. He said about Joe Biden that he didn't have a clue about foreign policy. He kind of enjoyed our mayor, Rahm Emanuel, but he found him to be just to have attention deficit disorder and to not to be really working in the public interest because everything was so knotted up in politics. That's a fascinating book because you don't expect it from somebody as buttoned up as Bob Gates.
Right.
And
so that one
he let go.
That's called Duty, A Memoir of a Secretary at War by Robert Gates in 2014. Richard's recommended book was POTUS Speaks. It was by Michael Waldman. And my producers are very efficiently telling me he was director of speech writing from 1995 to 1999. Let's go to Bridget in Springfield. Hi, Bridget. Welcome to the 21st. What's your book recommendation?
Well, All the King's Men by Robert Penn Warren, which is loosely based on Huey Long, the former governor of the state of Louisiana, and how politics operates and has operated in that state. It's an excellent read. It is fiction, but it's a classic in the political world.
Yeah, thanks for that, Bridget. Carol, it sounds like you're agreeing with her.
Oh, I am. And when you read a book that was published so many decades ago, and the Robert Penn Warren had it so right, and you realize that things have not changed, that the basic tenets of politics, of what makes people want to be politicians, and the, you know, for example, one of the things I've been thinking about this week is Tim Kaine, Hillary Clinton's
vice presidential pick.
Mm-hmm. He is going to run into a wall of fire as his campaign goes on because he took gifts from donors in Virginia while he was governor. Or it might have been while he was lieutenant governor, and it was perfectly legal under the Virginia law. But he has an interesting biography, and he is, I think, a very good man and a very ambitious man. He always has saw himself in the White House or next to the White House. So why do politicians do that? It's something that their lives are so public and they're so picked apart, and then they make these mistakes, and they do it over and over again, and they see the suffering. Look at the Republican governor of Virginia was set to go to prison before the Supreme Court helped him out. And that robbed.
Yeah. Thanks for that, Carol. We'll send out that link to what you're talking about a little bit further. There's a Washington Post story about Tim Kaine that we'll tweet out if you follow 21st. We just have a few minutes left. And Nanette, you have a couple more fiction books. Which other authors did you recommend if we want to just get apart from politics and just go straight into straight fiction and escapism? Tom Clancy?
Yes, absolutely. One of the first people I approached when I was invited to be on the show to talk about political books was my father. And he is a huge Tom Clancy fan. And he suggested the Jack Ryan series, which is well known, even if you haven't read the books, to people who have seen the movies, things like Clear and Present Danger.
And the books are better, I think.
The books
actually
are better.
Yeah.
Jack Ryan starts out in the beginning of the series as a CIA analyst. He becomes the CIA director. Very action-packed, very exciting. My dad would read these books in a day. He would sit in his chair and just read them. The other author that he mentioned was W.E.B. Griffin, who writes a series called Presidential Agent, which depicts international political issues from World War II through the present day. And he has several other series that also incorporate political elements.
Carol, one last book for you that I wanted to mention. If we don't get to the other ones, we have all the lists online, by the way, for everybody. So all the reading lists will be up at 21stshow.org. But let's talk about Mary McGrory before we close, the first queen of journalism. Yeah.
Yeah, I write biography, so I adore biography. I'm passionate about it. And I think that Mary McGrory, you read her life story. She died, I don't remember the date of her death, but she was born in 1918, and she went to work at journalism when women were writing for the women's pages and getting coffee and not taken seriously. But she started covering the Joe McCarthy hearings, and she was so perceptive and such a wonderful writer. And through her career, she's an old-time journalist, so she made friends with her subjects in the way that journalists today really would not want to do. They often do, but they shouldn't. So she was friends with Bobby Kennedy and with Ethel Kennedy. She was a dyed-in-the-wool Democrat. When I wrote a biography of Katharine Graham, and at that point, the Washington Star, which Mary McGrory adored, it was more of a working-class blue-collar paper than the snotty Washington Post. When the Star closed, Mary McGrory went to the Washington Post. And when I was writing my book about Kay Graham, she was one of the few people who would give me an interview. She was so brave, and she just was different from most of the people that I was trying to talk to. I interviewed her right in the Washington Post dining room, and Ben Bradley, with his sleeves rolled up and the shirts with the white pinstripes and white collars, was sitting right there, and she was fearless. She was and you can learn so much about politics from the 1950s on. And Watergate, it's almost as good as all the president's men.
Wow. Well, thanks for that. That's a ringing recommendation. Mary McGrory, the first queen of journalism. I want to thank Champaign Public Library's Nanette Donahue for joining us, and Carol Felsenthal. As you said, that book she was just talking about is called Power, Privilege, and the Post. She's also the author of other books, including Clinton in Exile, and you can catch her writing in Chicago Magazine and Politico and The Hill. Ladies, thank you for being with me.
Thank you.
Thank you.
The 21st is made possible by Kester & Bradley, LLP, providing legal services to the Urbana-Champaign community and Illinois residents since 1895. Kester & Bradley's attorneys are committed to achieving the best results for their clients. More information is available at KesterLawLLP.com.
Welcome back to the 21st. I'm Nyla Boodoo. As you may be aware, the state of Illinois is about a month into its second fiscal year without a state budget. That means healthcare providers with clients who are state employees are still not getting paid, even though the stopgap budget allowed the state to lift its hold on claim payments for state group health. What does this mean? Well, a couple weeks ago, we spoke with Dr. Benjamin Scott. He's a Champaign dentist who still owed several hundred thousand dollars by the state.
The temporary budget impasse helped a couple areas that were in need, but they did not affect the dentist. It's been approximately since August of last year since we'd gotten a payment from the state's Delta Dental. It's affecting everybody's everyday lives, and we are paying taxes, and we should expect to run like a normal functioning state.
Could there be relief in sight for Dr. Scott, for other dentists, doctors, healthcare providers throughout the state? Yesterday, the University of Illinois sent an email to all of its employees saying they'll be working with the Department of Central Management Services to try to get provider payments started back up again. The website for CMS states that the agency is actively reaching out to all of our carriers and working together to release a schedule of claim payments. They sent out a statement adding that the stopgap plan did not fully fund the state employee group insurance program, as you heard Dr. Scott say, and they say they are currently working with healthcare plan carriers to release a schedule. Spokesman Rich Carter with the Comptroller's Office told us this morning they'll be prioritizing payments for any vendor who didn't receive funding last year due to the budget impasse as soon as they receive those vouchers from CMS. As we wrap up this Friday, this weekend in Chicago, it's Lollapalooza, not just the biggest music festival in Illinois, but one of the biggest music events in the U.S. and the world. This year, it's Lolla's 25th anniversary. The four-day festival sold out before any artists were even announced. We're going to be joined soon by one of those artists, Evan Weiss, of the Chicago band Intuit Over It. Intuit Over It released its third full-length album called Standards back in March. Let's take a listen to No EQ from that album now. Welcome back to the 21st. That was the Chicago band Intuit Over It. The title, the track of that, No EQ, from the album Standards that was released back in March. They're going to be performing tonight at the Beat Kitchen in Chicago. It's part of an official Lollapalooza after-party show. And we're joined now by Evan Weiss, who's the brains behind Intuit Over It. Hey, Evan, welcome to the 21st. Thanks for joining us.
Hey, how are you?
Good. So you started this project as a solo act back in 2007, and now, obviously, you're in a very different place. You've got this full touring band playing on big stages. How has it been seeing your idea grow from what it was into where it is right now?
Pretty freaky and unexpected. The entire thing kind of started out as just a way to relieve some personal stress and be creative, and to see it kind of take on a life of its own has been something I've always wanted, but also something that kind of happened in a really organic and a really organic way through kind of a bizarre turn of events regarding me, like, gaining and losing jobs and just kind of getting asked to do tours when I wasn't necessarily prepared, and Yeah, it's been really
exciting. Well, that's really cool.
At this point, I kind of just let it take a life on its own, and I just kind of let it do its thing.
Well, it's great. I know it's so great to hear a musician say that, because I feel like for a lot of musicians, when I talk to them, that's not always the case. And I wanted to ask you, because you've been touring all summer off of your latest album, Standards. You're going to be on the road all the way through November. Has it always been this busy for you, even when you were touring by yourself?
Yeah, you know, and I'm actually on tour by myself right now. The show, the Bee Kitchen show tonight I'm playing is a solo show due to the nature of the show. It's just me and my friend Jeremy playing solo. But yeah, it's always been this busy. And I keep telling myself, like, no, like, next year I won't tour for 11 months. And then and then next year comes and it's like, we keep getting asked to do things, or we keep getting cool opportunities, and it's like, well, we got to do that. Well, we got to say yes to that. We got to do that thing. That sounds awesome. You know, like, it just, it never ends. And it's,
do you enjoy it, or do you feel like you kind of have to, or is it just, or do you really like it?
We really, really enjoy it. I think this year, in the spring of this year, we did a 9-week tour, and I don't think we can do that ever again. We definitely joked at the end of that, stretch, like, this was too long. We got to, you know, put a week off in the middle there somewhere next time we decide to do this. But yeah, absolutely, we still enjoy it. And I think about other jobs that I've had and punching clocks for other people, and
you'd much rather be doing this, obviously.
Yeah, absolutely. Like, yeah, I could complain. Like, me complaining is like complaining for sport. You know, I grew up in New Jersey, so it's like my nature. It's in my blood to complain.
You know, I was going to ask you about that, because it's so interesting that you went from the East Coast to being based in Chicago. How did that happen? It seems like a lot of musicians or groups do the opposite. Like, they start in Chicago and then they go to the coasts.
Yeah, they moved to New York or something.
Yeah.
I fell in love with the city at a really young age. I was 18 when I went to Chicago the first time, and just really enjoyed the vibe. I really felt like it was kind of like a more polite version of living in, like, growing up in South New Jersey. And
more polite,
you know,
yeah.
The music scene was always
less complaining, like, too, I would bet.
You know, I kind of toe that line. I've inspired a lot of my new Midwestern friends to complain all the time, too. So it's good. I'm rubbing off on them in a positive way.
Yeah, I always say there's social pressure to behave well here. That's how I describe Illinois and the Midwest
totally,
and Chicago.
Yeah. The Midwest values, it's a whole different thing for me, because I'm just, you know, blunt and to the point. And I've definitely curbed my behavior since living out here.
So,
but I really enjoyed the vibe of the city. I think it's beautiful. I think it's affordable. I think it's, you know, and the people are all really friendly and supportive. And it's been a great place to play music. I mean, plus you're centrally located in the country. So if you're doing this as a career, you know, you're kind of right smack in the middle. So anything you'd have to do or start, you're not too far from where you need to be.
Hey, let's play another one of your songs, Anesthetic, right? Because we were just talking about you doing your sort of acoustic guitar and your voice. Before we play the song, do you want to tell us a little bit about it?
Song is actually about it's written from the perspective of somebody else, and kind of also dealing with what I thought it would be like to be, the music is supposed to be kind of this dream state of what you would hear, what you would feel if you were under local anesthesia. But the song is written from the perspective of a friend who was kind of going through this time a couple of years ago. And I thought his story was pretty interesting, and you know, wanted to write a song about that.
Cool. Let's play a little bit of it. That's a little bit of Anesthetic. We're talking to Evan Weiss. That's his song. He's a musician from the band Intuit, Over It. They're playing at a Lala after party show in Chicago tonight. And as you were describing that acoustic guitar in your voice, I imagine that transitions well into a live solo set. Do you have songs like that for that purpose?
You know, not necessarily. I never really thought about it that way. Like, whenever I'm writing, I don't think about, like, well, you know, I need to be able to perform the solo also, you know, and I've just kind of always, what started out with such a large catalog, because the first thing I did was this 52 song project. that I was able to just kind of pick songs from that I thought worked really well. And then ever since then, there's usually about half of every record works really appropriately in a solo environment. And especially now that I've been touring more and that Intuit Overt's a little bit more established, when people come to see it, they kind of know what to expect if it's a solo show. And so now I'm able to play even the more quiet and beautiful songs without people talking, which has been really, really awesome lately when getting to play these solo shows and really getting to like play some of the stuff that I never used to get to play.
And everyone's listening. That's great.
Right. Yeah, because it used to be me, like, you know, I'd have to come out. You have to come out swinging when nobody knows who you are. You have to, you know, just kind of, hey, I'm here. You know, check me out.
Listen to this. Right.
Yeah.
Do you feel like playing a Lala after party, does that put you in front of a whole new audience? Or do you find that your audience is people who already know you? Like, what are you expecting for tonight?
I mean, yeah, in Chicago, it's probably going to be a lot of friends. I think the show that we're playing tonight is, you know, my friend Jeremy is, you know, a pretty influential figurehead in a scene that I'm pretty deeply immersed in. And I think tonight is going to be a lot of people that I know. And that's comforting. It's also terrifying. You know, you play in front of all your friends together. Like, if you don't do it right, you have to go back home and answer to those people. And, like, they're going to give you a hard time. But, you know, I've done a lot of stuff kind of associated with Lala over the last couple of years. And Lollapalooza has always been super, as an organization, has been super warm to Intuit Overt, which has been really, really cool considering it's one of like three enormous festivals that happen in Chicago in the spring over like a 1 month period every single year. So, you know, we had the show planned and Lala came to us and we're kind of like, hey, do you want us to, you know, can we make this a
oh, cool. So that's how it happened. And okay.
Yeah. The show was already booked and it was supposed to happen earlier in the night. And then they took it under their wing and
so then it had to be later because it's like an after party show, right?
Sure, yeah, which is actually better because people will, you know, be leaving the festival and be able to come.
Well, and the Bee Kitchen's a good venue for that, right? Because it's a little smaller, like it's a perfect kind of after party venue.
Oh, it's awesome! It's one of my favorite places to play in the city. I think it sounds great. It's like it's the perfect size to see a show. It feels really intimate, but also, you know, you can fit a lot of people in there.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. So is it crazy that this is the 25th anniversary of Lollapalooza? I wanted to ask you about that, right? Because I wonder, as you're seeing the festival, if you feel like I don't know if you went to it before you were in it, but how you think, I'm curious your thoughts on how you think the festival, if it's changed or evolved or what you think about it.
I mean, I remember when I was a kid and it was a touring festival and I remember wanting to go so bad. It was like all of my favorite bands were on the same thing. And I remember the Philadelphia show. I never got to go. And I remember the Philadelphia show 1 year was the show where Rage Against the Machine came out naked. And I was like, oh, I could have,
you could have been
this,
there.
Like, epic event. Right. Yeah. Well, you know, if only my, you know, I was like 14 years old. I was like,
if only my parents, had let me see Rage Against the Machine. Right. Nude.
So, you know, I always wanted to go. And then, when it switched to Chicago, you know, in the time that I was living in Chicago, when the festival moved to just being a Chicago event, definitely the first series of years that I was living in the city, I was absolutely too broke to afford a Lollapalooza ticket. So I actually never got to go until we played. But when we played, it was awesome. You know, the treatment of the bands that play that festival is unbelievable. And they really go out of their way to make everybody feel super comfortable and really well taken care of. And you can tell that it's people who were in a band or in bands running the event, which, you know, Perry Farrell's been, you know, I love Jane's Addiction and I love Porno for Pyros. And I, you know, and you can tell that he has the musician's best interest in mind. It's really, really cool.
That's Evan Weiss. He's a musician from the band Intuit Over It. They are, Evan's playing tonight at an official after party for Lollapalooza at the Beat Kitchen at 9:00. Thanks so much, Evan.
Yeah, appreciate it. Appreciate you. I'm on my drive right now back to Chicago from Minneapolis. This was a nice pit stop.
Yeah, great. Okay, so before we play a song for you, I just want to say thanks to everybody. That's all the time we have for today. Thanks to our great staff here, Philip Kisabika, Christine Herman, Sean Newman, and Travis Stansel. Howla Delahi also assists on the show. Technical direction comes from Jason Croft with help from Steve Mork. Scott Cameron is our news director. We want to thank Joe Yoon and Nick Vance from the University of Illinois Social Media Analytics Lab for their research help. And special thanks to the band Public Access for our theme music. Before we go out today, we're going to play one last song for you. It's the last track from Intuit Over It, their latest album, Standards. It's going to take us into the weekend. It's called Required Reading. I'm Nyla Boodoo. Thanks for listening to The 21st, and take a listen to Required Reading.
Scale the tips towards unfortunate ends. He's in.